Supreme Court watchers have been eagerly awaiting decisions in a number of high-profile cases that deal with everything from gay marriage to voting rights. But today, the court only tackled one of the major cases before it, affirmative action. Sort of. Joining us now is Emily Bazelon, senior editor for Slate, the Truman Capote Fellow at Yale Law School, and a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. Welcome back to our show.
Thanks so much for having me.
The Supreme Court issued a 7-1 decision this morning in the case Fisher versus University of Texas. Was this a sweeping ruling on affirmative action, the kind of thing that many had expected, or did they keep it fairly limited?
They kept it fairly limited. It was the opposite of a sweeping ruling, I would say, in which Justice Kennedy, for the rest of the court, basically just said that courts, lower courts, have to use a more skeptical standard in scrutinizing universities' affirmative action policies.
It's interesting that in this court that is so often divided 5-4, that this is a 7-1 decision. Who is the dissenter?
The dissenter is Justice Clarence Thomas. And the dissenter is Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And what she said was that the University of Texas Austin did exactly what it should have in this case. It was upfront about using race as one factor among many. And Justice Ginsburg said, look, that's what our previous decisions upholding the use of affirmative action for the sake of diversity have told schools to do.
In fact, there was a Supreme Court decision in 2003 in which the Supreme Court allowed universities to take race into consideration. Do you think that the court decided to take this case up again so soon, just 10 years later, because its makeup has changed so much?
I think that's definitely one factor. It was Justice Sandra Day O'Connor who wrote that 2003 decision, and she famously said, you know what, we need race-based affirmative action for another 25 years. Now we're 10 years on, she has been replaced by Justice Samuel Alito, who is much more conservative than she is generally, and in particular on matters of race. So I certainly think that his substitution for her helps explain why the court took this case. But then this kind of halfway punt of a decision today suggests that the conservative justices decided they did not have a good vehicle for really rolling back affirmative action.
The case was brought by a white woman named Abigail Fisher, who applied to University of Texas in 2008, said that it was the only school she wanted to go to and was denied admission. How did this turn into a case about affirmative action?
The University of Texas Austin has this interesting admissions policy where they admit most of the entering freshman class by what's called their top 10% program. And that means they take the top 10% of every high school. And because Texas's schools are pretty segregated, they admit a fair number of Black and Hispanic students that way, in addition to white students. But then there are about 20% of the slots in the freshman class that go through a more holistic admissions process. And at that point, race becomes one factor among many. Abigail Fisher did not get into UT Austin, and she says that's because she's white, that her race counted against her.
And is that why other people picked up the case? Did they see this as a way of overturning the entire affirmative action system?
Originally what they hoped for, and Abigail Fisher seemed like a pretty good plaintiff, a white applicant who'd been denied admission. But then the facts of the case got more complicated. To begin with, it's not clear that Abigail Fisher would have been admitted to the University of Texas Austin even if she were not white. She just didn't have really high scores. So that was a problem generally. And then the other thing is that the plaintiffs made a decision in this case not to challenge the very basic question, which is whether considering race in admissions in any way violates the Constitution, whether that denies equal protection of the laws to white people, essentially a kind of reverse discrimination suit. And by skirting that question, the plaintiffs ended up with this kind of half a loaf ruling.
Why do you think they decided not to try that strategy?
That going after the 2003 case we were talking about earlier, going after it directly might be too much and might scare off Justice Kennedy, who is clearly the swing vote on the court. And so what we ended up with today was this 7-1 ruling written by Kennedy in which he says, well, you know, I'm not sure, or lower courts might not be sure about this particular race-based affirmative action program, but we're going to leave the question overall of whether we can continue affirmative action for another day.
Hasn't the Roberts Court gone in for large sweeping rulings? Does this say anything about anything new about the way the court is thinking?
You know, sometimes the court takes a big bite. I mean, we certainly saw that in Citizens United, right? The case which struck down campaign finance reform. But then other times this is a court that takes more incremental steps. Like, for example, in 2009, there was a ruling upholding the Voting Rights Act. Now we're back again this term with another case we're all waiting for with a lot of anticipation, wondering if the court will take a more dramatic step to strike down part of the Voting Rights Act. So I think you see here a case that was not positioned well for a big step, and also some degree of caution on the part of some of the conservative justices.
Was the ruling expected after the oral arguments, or did the court throw observers something of a curveball?
I'd say this was pretty expected after oral argument, because it just seemed like the UT admissions plan was so specific that there were a lot of ways the court could say, well, you know what? I mean, the way they're doing admissions at this school, maybe it's not great, but does it really have big implications for all these other schools? They would really have had to reach pretty far beyond the facts of this case to make a sweeping ruling to ban affirmative action nationwide.
So following this ruling, will the program that Fisher was challenging continue to operate?
It will continue to operate, and what will happen is the case goes back to the lower courts, and the Fifth Circuit, the Court of Appeals in this case, will take another look. This time, they will not defer to the university's a profession that it needs to do this exact program for diversity's sake. The court will be more skeptical. They're supposed to drill down into the evidence to make sure there's no race-neutral way to get the same kind of diversity benefits. So we'll just have to see what happens. No one lost and no one won today.
The court has said that it'll be back with more rulings at 10 a.m. tomorrow. How many more rulings are left? Are they the cases that most people are aware of, dealing with California's Prop 8 and the Defense of Marriage Act and the Voting Rights Act, the only ones?
They're not the only ones. They're just the ones we're all super waiting for. But there actually, I believe, are 7 cases left. And so it's entirely likely that we will get some of them tomorrow and then some of them on either Wednesday or Thursday. But the court has not said which or whether of those days it will hear more, it will deliver more cases on yet.
Now, why does the court choose to wait until the end? Is it simply because they have to find out where Kennedy is going to go on all the decisions?
Are really hard, and they take a lot of time, and there tends to be a lot of back and forth among the justices in writing dissents. Sometimes majorities can shift over time, and then sometimes they want to respond to each other. So that, I think, accounts for the amount of time. And the gay
marriage, it's not theatrics.
No, I don't think so. The gay marriage cases, you know, were argued very late in the term. So that's another thing. They just haven't had all that much time, actually, to write those opinions.
And from what we saw during the oral arguments, do we have any sense of where Kennedy is going to go? Is he likely to be the swing state in the Voting Rights Act, DOMA, and Prop 8?
Well, with the gay marriage cases, I thought that Kennedy did a little bit of signaling that he is pretty sympathetic to gay people who want to get married. There was one moment in argument where he talked about the voices of the children, and he was talking about children adopted by gay parents who would presumably benefit from more stability if their parents could get married. So we'll have to see whether and how that plays out. I would say that's like the big $20,000 question we're all waiting for.
Emily Bazelon is senior editor for Slate, the Truman Capote Fellow at Yale Law School, and a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thanks so much for having me. My pleasure.